This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, Australia tightly binds its defence to the US and UK for generations to come. Today's strategic agreement allows the Navy's next submarines to be nuclear-powered, sending a message about China's challenge. Former Labor Defence Minister Stephen Smith is my guest.
Australia needs to have the best possible capability it can have access to, but other efforts need to include working not just with the US and the UK, but with our other like-minded partners to seek to balance China's strategic competition that it's now engaged in and argue to China that it needs to revert to the China that we knew until 2013, 2014, 2015.
And the Greens claim the subs would present a nuclear risk. We'll have a look at the facts.
We're not going to see a mushroom cloud in the sky, but we could have criticality accident where you have nuclear material spread, and then you could have lingering high levels of radiation in the area for decades. You know, this is not something to be toyed with lightly.
Welcome to the program. Australia has made one of its most momentous strategic decisions in decades. The government is tearing up a $90 billion contract with France to build a fleet of new submarines, unveiling instead an ambitious plan to make the Navy's next submarine fleet nuclear-powered. It's part of a sweeping new defence and technology-sharing partnership unveiled by the United States, Australia and the United Kingdom, labelled AUKUS. Our Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts begins our coverage.
Images of both peace and war were beamed over a video screen as Scott Morrison, Joe Biden and Boris Johnson strode to their podiums in London, Washington and Canberra for a coordinated international announcement.
A new enhanced trilateral security partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States.
The statements were heavy on symbolism.
Today we're taking another historic step to deepen and formalise cooperation among all three of our nations.
Reflecting the measure of trust between us, the depth of our friendship, and the enduring strength of our shared values of freedom and democracy.
But at its heart was an announcement of real weight and consequence. The United States and the United Kingdom vowing to hand over closely guarded technological secrets to help Australia build its own fleet of nuclear-powered submarines.
The first major initiative of AUKUS will be to deliver a nuclear-powered submarine fleet for Australia. Over the next 18 months, we will work together to seek to determine the best way forward to achieve this.
And in one stroke, Mr. Morrison also confirmed Australia had ditched the biggest and most expensive single defence contract in Australian history, a $90 billion agreement with a French company to build up to 12 conventional submarines. The French submarine project had been plagued by cost overruns, delays and internal recriminations. But according to the Prime Minister, that wasn't why the contract has been torn up. Instead, Scott Morrison said the government was embracing a new technology to deal with a new, uncertain era.
The relatively benign security environment that Australia has enjoyed over many decades in our region is behind us. We have entered, no doubt, a new era.
The Prime Minister painted a grim picture of an increasingly contested and unstable region. And that means Australia now wants nuclear-powered submarines, which are capable of staying underwater for months on end and are therefore much harder for enemies to detect.
Nuclear submarines have clear advantages. Greater endurance, they're faster, they have greater power, greater stealth, more carrying capacity. These make nuclear submarines the desired substantial capability enhancement that Australia has needed.
And now, unlike earlier, the Americans are willing to give us the technology. The reasons seem clear. Neither Joe Biden, Scott Morrison or Boris Johnson mention China by name. But it's clear Beijing's massive military build-up and increasing suspicions about its intentions inform the strategic calculus of decision-makers in Washington, London and Canberra. And a shared desire to constrain or at least balance China seems to inform what the Prime Minister Scott Morrison called a forever partnership.
A forever partnership for a new time between the oldest and most trusted of friends.
Analysts say the ramifications of this choice are clear. Sam Roggeveen from the Lowy Institute says the government's decision is momentous.
We are tying our fortunes now. One of the core weapon systems for our national defence, we are tying that to maintaining close relations with the United States and the UK, because we cannot operate these submarines by ourselves. So we're tying ourselves ever more closely to the US and the UK, with all the risks that that entails.
And the shift doesn't come cheap. The government's already ploughed more than $2 billion into the French submarines project. Tearing up this contract will likely cost another $400 million or so, leaving Labour leader Anthony Albanese a clear opening.
After 8 years, three prime ministers, six defence ministers, and billions of dollars of sunken costs in this program, this is the most expensive example of something that has characterised this government: its ability to promise, but its inability to deliver.
Still, the AOP says it accepts the logic behind the government's decision. Mr Albanese says if the government can keep to its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and doesn't try to embrace a civil nuclear industry, Labor will back the decision. The Prime Minister's also stressing Australia has no interest in acquiring nuclear weapons and is vowing that Australia will take every precaution with the new technology.
We take the stewardship responsibilities of this nuclear capability very seriously. It is a forever responsibility for a forever partnership.
It's also yet another new risk in an era where they seem to be multiplying rapidly.
Our foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgett's there. So the agreement has bipartisan support, but the French are furious. Their foreign minister has called the cancellation of their contract a knife in the back and a betrayal. But it's China that's at the heart here, and it says the move damages regional peace and stability. Well, Stephen Smith is a former Labor Defence and Foreign Affairs Minister. He's now Professor of Public International Law at the University of Western Australia. We spoke earlier.
Firstly, a strategic partnership at the defence or military level with the United States and the United Kingdom and Australia is an unambiguously good thing. It's got strong bipartisan support, and that's essential when we're dealing with our alliance interests and our national security and strategic interests. So I very much welcome that there's strong bipartisanship support for this going forward. And with submarines, it's clear that after 8 years, the government was having significant difficulty with various permutations for replacement of the Collins-class submarine. The best capability option we have in the national interest is now nuclear. And if we're going to go nuclear propulsion, taking care of all of our international nuclear obligations with respect to non-proliferation and our long-standing policy interest of not having a nuclear civil industry in Australia, then the US and the UK were the only countries we could look to.
These submarines won't arrive, if assuming they do, until after 2033, when the French submarines were roughly due. How does that timeline help with Australia's security now, given that the horse is pretty much bolted in terms of China's military expansion, and that's really what this is about, right?
When the government came to office, it had everything it needed to move forward on what was described as a son or daughter of Collins. The work that was done under the Coles Review and the work in terms of life extension had the Collins in the water, 4 to 6 submarines in the water at any given time. The government, for whatever reason, when it came to look at the Collins, excluded the relevant European company, Cockham's. We also got entangled in turning a quiet conversation with the Japanese over submarines to a diplomatic debacle with the Japanese, which didn't help. But when the government chose the French submarine, it was a surprise to many in the intelligence, defence, security community. It was certainly the highest risk project, using a unique propulsion system, which the French had designed for a nuclear submarine, and converting that to conventional. So it's no surprise that there were problems with that. I note the Prime Minister is seeking to downplay that, and he's doing that for good diplomatic reasons. He doesn't want the same diplomatic debacle with the French that the Abbott government had with the Japanese over submarines.
The French are very cranky about this decision to tear up that contract. It's already cost us $2 billion and it's going to cost a lot more. Who should be accountable for that?
I'll leave it to the present day practitioners to argue about that. The French have got more assets in the Indo-Pacific than any other European country. And the French were keen not just to do submarines, but to expand their relationship with Australia and other partners in the Indo-Pacific. What I hope might be able to occur is once the French get over the disappointment of losing the submarines, that they continue to embrace the notion of the Indo-Pacific and work to do things with Australia and other partners. Balancing China, or seeking to say to China, we want you to revert to conducting yourself as a good international citizen, can't just require Australia, the US and the UK. It has to be a whole of Indo-Pacific effort to seek to balance China. And that's why Australia needs to have the best possible capability it can have access to, but other efforts need to include working not just with the US and the UK, but with our other like-minded partners doing similar things to seek to balance China's strategic competition that it's now engaged in, and argue to China that it needs to revert to the China that we knew essentially from 1972 until 2013, 2014, 2015.
China is already of the view that the West is trying to constrain it, that there is a campaign against it effectively. Doesn't this just throw oil on that fire?
Well, China needs to accept that the China we're dealing with now is a changed China from which Australia dealt with for very many years. And if you look at ignoring the Permanent Court of Arbitration decision about maritime territory and island territory in the South China Sea, what it's doing with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province, what it's done in Hong Kong, its array of cyber attacks, its economic punishment of Australia and others, including over time Japan and Korea, we're dealing with a changed China, a much more assertive and aggressive China, and we need to seek to balance that.
Stephen Smith, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Linda. Thanks a lot.
Former Labor Defence and Foreign Affairs Minister Stephen Smith. More of that interview at the PM webpage. Well, the word nuclear is politically charged in this country. Intensely held views are already being expressed about the safety of submarines with nuclear reactors on board docking in Australian ports. And while the Prime Minister has issued an assurance that there's no intention to establish a civil nuclear capability for Australia off the back of this submarine decision, critics fear this will open the door for those in the government who see nuclear power as the answer to reaching net zero carbon emissions. David Lipson reports.
Up till 3am on an entirely separate matter, the ANU's head of nuclear physics, Professor Andrew Stutchbury, woke late to a landscape transformed in his chosen field.
I got up about 8 and my wife said they've just announced that they're going to build nuclear submarines with a deal, and there was already about 50 emails in my inbox.
Until now, many of his students haven't had a clear career path to actually apply their skills in nuclear science.
It is exciting for new career opportunities, not just to make these submarines work well, but to make sure that they operate safely for anybody, everybody's benefit.
In strategic terms, the advantages of nuclear submarines are clear, according to Dr. Marcus Hellyer from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
With a highly enriched uranium reactor, you don't need to refuel it, and it's essentially producing enough energy to move an 8,000-ton vessel through the water at around about 60 kilometres an hour for 30 years.
But such wonders of technology require the highest levels of expertise, of which the Australian Navy currently has very little.
You know, when you look at US nuclear submarines, the skipper of that submarine, you know, has had a 25-year career, and they actually have to understand all of the nuclear engineering. You know, we've got a long road ahead of us to develop, you know, comparable skills.
The larger question is whether Australia can feasibly become the only nation on Earth with nuclear-propelled submarines but no civilian nuclear capacity to support them.
It looks like the government has answered that question to its own satisfaction and reached the conclusion that you can just go out and buy that technology. But what it does mean is that, again, you are very reliant on your partner to provide and maintain that technology.
Even with all the support in the world, Australia still needs to bridge a huge gap in human capital in order to safely run and maintain a fleet of floating nuclear reactors. That's according to Maria Rubley, an associate professor at Monash University.
In terms of the regulatory space, in terms of practicalities, you know, the type of health equipment you would need to have on site. I mean, there's a huge blank, empty area where we just don't have any experience. We don't know what needs to be done there, and we don't know how much it's going to cost.
There is time to prepare and build capacity, around 2 decades before the first submarine is operational. But Associate Professor Rubley says in this space, there's no room for error.
You know, we're not going to see a mushroom cloud in the sky, but we could have a criticality accident where you have nuclear material spread. You could have people die, and then you could have, you know, lingering high levels of radiation in the area for decades. You know, this is not something to be toyed with lightly.
I think it is an enormous step that the government is taking, and it's one that appears to be taking without a great deal of thought, and certainly not without any public thought.
Richard Tanter is a senior research associate at the Nautilus Institute, a defence and sustainability think tank. He's concerned about the lack of public debate on an issue of such grave importance.
So it begins with nuclear safety. It goes through to maintenance. Even if the fuel cells are not recharged during the lifetime of the submarine, they will need to be examined closely and in some cases repaired on site. So for that, we need a nuclear engineering capability of some substance.
And he believes that could pave the way for Australia to play a much bigger role on the nuclear stage.
It also actually aligns with the preferences of the Deputy Prime Minister at the moment for nuclear civil engineering in Australia as a solution to climate change. So it does open up the possibility there of nuclear power in Australia more generally.
To date, the politics of all matters nuclear have been almost as toxic as the byproduct. There could yet be choppy waters ahead.
David Lipson with that report. Well, Victoria and New South Wales are racing to get vaccination rates up as they contemplate new freedoms in the coming weeks. But doctors are warning that no restrictions should be eased before 80% of all eligible citizens are fully vaccinated. Both states are working on the plan for the rules that would apply to the unvaccinated at that stage. But what human rights requirements might they run up against? Gavin Coote reports.
Despite Victoria recording 514 new cases, the highest daily tally since the peak of its second wave last year, Premier Daniel Andrews is making good on a promise to grant small freedoms.
We've got more cases today, but we have a very high test number. We have a very high vaccine number. We said that when we got the 70% first dose, we'd be able to do some modest but meaningful things. And that's exactly what we're announcing today.
From Friday, vaccinated Melbourne and Ballarat residents will be allowed to gather outdoors in groups of up to 5 if they've had 2 doses.
These are modest. We've never tried to oversell them, but they're not unimportant. They are meaningful, but they're not meaningful in terms of adding, you know, disproportionate amount of risk to having more and more cases.
But doctors, via the Australian Medical Association, say easing restrictions before 80% of all Victorians aged over 12 are fully immunised would be reckless. Roderick McRae is the group's Victorian president.
And I'd hasten to point out that even when we get to 80% of people double vaccinated and waited the 2 weeks till they have their maximum cover, there's still something in the order of 5 million Australians and 1.6 million Victorians who are wide open. They have no vaccination.
In New South Wales, a second day in a row of 12 new COVID deaths. And with 1,351 new cases in New South Wales, Deputy Chief Health Officer Marianne Gale says it isn't yet clear whether infection numbers have peaked.
We're cautiously optimistic, seeing these numbers being relatively stable day to day, bouncing around a bit. We may yet see an increase.
New South Wales is on track to have 70% of over 16-year-olds fully vaccinated by mid-next month, triggering an easing of lockdown orders only for those who've had 2 shots. Health Minister Brad Hazzard says the government is still getting legal advice on how things would work once it hits the 80% mark and whether people dodging vaccines can still be barred from venues.
Those issues have to be resolved in the next few weeks, but I just remind everybody that individuals themselves, it is incumbent upon you not to enter premises unless you are doubly vaccinated.
Employment groups have been looking for clarity on this, and Kate Ogg, an expert on human rights law at the Australian National University, thinks business will need some more direction from governments, though she points out there's already a precedent, including in childcare centres.
So there is a really important freedom of movement argument.
But of course, on the flip side, for those people, especially people who might be more vulnerable to catching COVID-19 or having more serious side effects, their rights are the right to health and the right to life.
Kate Ogg says in New South Wales, there aren't all that many legal options for those to raise human rights complaints.
So New South Wales doesn't have a Human Rights Act, so equivalent to, for example, the Human Rights Act in the ACT. Now, people in New South Wales can make a complaint to the UN Human Rights Committee. The problem with that, though, is it's a bit of a toothless tiger.
She does expect the more thorny legal issues will be around the right to privacy.
When we think about the fact that we have to be checked before we enter a public place to see if we are vaccinated or not, that is going to create a lot of data. And there are really important questions about where is that data stored and who gets access to that data.
Human rights law expert Kate Ogg, Gavin Coote, our reporter there. Well, a former top Canadian health official says COVID vaccination rates of 90% of adults will likely be needed to keep control of the Delta variant of the virus. James Talbot is a past chief medical officer for health in Alberta, where a fourth wave of COVID has slammed the hospitals, with ICU beds reaching their limits, despite more than 71% of over 12-year-olds being fully vaccinated. Authorities there imposed a state of health emergency overnight, reluctantly. I spoke with Professor Talbot, who's currently in Toronto.
Right now, we're experiencing the worst pressure that we've had. We've had three waves. The first wave, we moved to shut down fairly quickly, and so that was good work by the government and by public health, and we kept mortality relatively low. We've had a second and a third wave as the government has undergone premature relaxing and allowed cases to increase, and they did that again July 1st, and we're in the middle of a fourth wave in which we are running more than 130% over capacity for ICU beds.
And when the relaxation of restrictions and public health measures has happened, what levels of vaccination were in the community at those times?
So over the age of 12, July 1st, when they relaxed, we would have been around 66% fully immunized and 72% or so with one dose. We would have been down to around 50 cases per day for a population of 4.3 million. You know, that's roughly 15 cases per million. You know, at that point, the politicians looked at the situation and said, well, that's good. Mission accomplished.
And was the mission accomplished in the way they intended?
No. I mean, many of the people who were in the medical and scientific establishment and as a group that I was associated with pointed out that Delta was just so much more transmissible that it was inevitable that we would see it become the dominant strain, and then we would begin to see it rocket upwards, and that removing all of the precautions at the same time guaranteed that the wave that would result from that would not be a long, slow wave of illness that the system could cope with. It was going to be a tidal wave that was going to overtop our capacity to deal with it. And that's exactly what's been happening. And in September, situations got even worse because the government didn't change its policy and kids went back to school. They started to open up workplaces, and in Canada, it gets cooler in September, so more and more activities are being held indoors where transmission is a lot easier.
Mm. So to be clear, right now, what public health measures or lockdowns are in place in Alberta? Are there any?
The only one that they've reluctantly put in place is they're requiring masking when people are indoors, but there's no maximum capacity in establishments. There's no distinguishing between essential services and non-essential services. There's not even a requirement that bars and restaurants, if they're going to stay open, can only do pickup and outside service, which would be a minimum level of protection. And in consequence, we went from 50 cases a day to we're now routinely over 1,500 cases a day.
So if we look to Australia and New South Wales, by the end of October, roughly, we'll get to about 70% of the eligible population fully vaccinated. That's over 16s. And that's, you know, the moment when there'll be an easing of restrictions. Now, no one's saying a complete lifting, but what do you think about that number as a point for double vaccination for starting to ease restrictions?
Well, first of all, I mean, getting to 70% for an adult vaccine is world class, so good on you. But unfortunately, the Delta variant is behaving more like measles in terms of how easily it can transmit. And that means we're probably going to have to get up around 90% to be fully safe. And so the one thing I can say with some authority is you should not do what Alberta did. Don't relax everything at the same time, and don't be pig-headed about not going slow.
James Talbot, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. I hope you learn from our experiences and you continue to make good choices.
James Talbot is the former top doctor for Alberta and Nunavut and is now professor in public health at the University of Alberta. We also discussed his observations about the treatment of overstretched health workers. That's in a longer version of the interview at the PM webpage. Well, the cost of ongoing lockdowns has shown up in millions of lost hours of work in the latest official job figures. The so-called headline unemployment rate fell to 4.5% in August. But again, that was mainly due to hundreds of thousands of workers giving up on the job search. Women continue to take the brunt of the hit to the labour market, with dire warnings about their future prospects if more government support isn't forthcoming. Here's business reporter David Taylor.
Ian Grant and his wife live in Horsham in northwest Victoria. He's a truckie and his wife's a house cleaner, but they're not making much money between them right now. He spoke to us from his truck outside Centrelink.
Just been to Centrelink, but they've actually said that the coronavirus supplement of $450 a week has been cancelled. So because that's been cancelled, she has to go either on unemployment to get money, although she's still employed.
So she's working 0 hours effectively.
Well, 0 hours for no money.
Bureau of Statistics figures today show 66 million hours of work lost in August. But job losses were heavy too, with 146,000 Australians out of work, evenly distributed between full-time and part-time roles. RMIT economics lecturer Leonora Rees says women are taking the brunt of the job losses, and in many cases, they're not looking for more work.
That means we've got workers dropping out of the workforce. They've either given up looking for a job, it's too hard to find a job, they've got caring responsibilities.
Unions are urging the Morrison government to bring back some form of JobKeeper to give Australian workers a safety net that's not offered by disaster payments. There's no suggestion the government will do this. Minister for Employment, Stuart Robert, concedes it's difficult for those out of lockdown and out of work.
Oh, it's difficult, especially when employers put you on 0 hours.
Deputy Labor Leader Richard Miles says all of the job and household budget pain can be brought back to what he says is the government's failed vaccination rollout.
One of the single biggest failures in public administration that we have seen in our country's history.
But economist Leonora Rees says while it may be tough for some to hear, the pandemic is revolutionising the way we work, and too many workers are not adapting with it.
Perhaps you do need to move into a slightly different type of business, or you need to adapt and do things in a digital format rather than an in-person experience, for instance.
And adapt is precisely what these workers have done.
Hi, my name's Marnie Groom. I'm nearly 50 years of age and I've just recently relocated to the Northern Territory from WA.
Hi there. My name is Michelle Napier. I am 36 and I've come from Canberra in the ACT.
They're all now working for Northern Territory recruitment firm ALPA, or Arnhem Land Progress Aboriginal Corporation. It places mainly Indigenous Australians in retail positions throughout the territory. People and Culture Manager Brad George says he's had to boost staff to cater for the enormous demand for workers.
We are looking for 25 retail managers at the moment, looking for 25 community development staff. We could fill another 5 finance roles tomorrow.
While there are pockets around the country enjoying a jobs boom, economists say East Coast pandemics will continue to wreak havoc on businesses and their ability to hire. and a strong recovery is not guaranteed. Indeed, consulting firm EY claims if you take out the effect of workers giving up on the job search, the unemployment rate is more likely to be roughly 10%. Employment Minister Stuart Robert says that's rubbish.
Lies, damn lies and statistics. Numbers will continue to be all over the place.
Employment Minister Stuart Robert speaking with our reporter David Taylor. And that is PM for this Thursday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. You can hear us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to the PM podcast in the usual places.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.